You are listening to lecture number 2, Hardware Continued, delivered by David J. Malin for Computer Science E1, Understanding Computers and the Internet, at Harvard University's Extension School, on Thursday, September 29. Visit us on the web at www.fas.harvard.edu/CSCIE1.
Welcome, this is Computer Science E1. My name is David Malin, and this is Lecture 2, Hardware Continued. Ever so slightly cheesy music aside, it's actually a wonderful movie, and it will be the focus of next week, Lecture 3, Software, replete with free popcorn and free soda. And as I mentioned at Lecture 1, by all means feel free to bring family and friends, since it literally will be the first of E1's two movie nights. Tonight, though, we continue our discussion of hardware. Recall that we concluded last week by looking at the basic building blocks of any computational device, whether it is a calculator or today whether it is a computer. Well, what we're going to do tonight is actually put a case around these very basics that we introduced last week. But first, let's just recall where we ended up. So we had this sort of pipeline, recall, last week. And a few questions for you. You go ahead and click Save under a program's File menu, and you thereby saving your resume. Where in this pipeline does it end up being stored? Yeah, so it was on the hard drive, recall. And the hard drive was an example of non-volatile storage, which is just a way of saying that when you pull the plug on your computer, you do not lose that data. Well, why was that? Why do you not lose data when you pull the plug or shut down your computer if that data has been stored on your hard drive, whereas you do if it were only in RAM? Yeah, it's a difference of electronics. So recall that RAM is an entirely electronic device, which means you need a constant presence of electricity if you want to maintain those bits inside of the RAM, whereas a hard drive is a magnetic device, not unlike the floppy disks that we took apart last week. In fact, if you're newly joining us tonight, do take a moment at some point tonight to take one of the floppy disks over by the window, crack it open, perhaps at the guidance of someone sitting next to you, and you'll see exactly what comprises these floppy disks. In fact, there's really not all that much. Well, we said that inside of a computer's hard drive, such as this, are what? Exactly. cookie-like items, but they're not quite so floppy. We called them platters at the conclusion of last week, but the principle is the same. Recall that last week we said that on a floppy disk, you have all these tiny little magnetic particles, and if you align them in one direction, those particles are representing, say, zeros. If you align them the other direction, they're representing ones. And with those building blocks, we said computers can achieve most any operation today, though most of those are fundamentally based in mathematics. Well, a hard drive operates exactly the same way, aligning magnetic particles on these so-called platters. But in a hard drive, these platters are not floppy like cookies. They're more firm. They're made of actual metal, and there's usually several of them inside of the hard drive. And we'll take a look at that in just a second. But first, let's round out last week's discussion by putting some numbers up on the board yet again. Numbers as they might relate to you, the home user, or you, the consumer. So, hard drive. This is a type of memory. Okay? How much hard disk space does a typical computer have these days? 20 or 40 gigabytes. That's good. So let's say 20 gigabytes, 40 gigabytes. What else might be reasonable these days? 80 gigabytes. Sorry? 120. You might see 200. I said last week you've even seen these days drives as large as 400 gigabytes. And this is just on a typical machine. Bear in mind that 400 gigabytes is approaching the next bit of nomenclature. Recall last week we talked about kilobytes, and we talked about megabytes, and we talked about gigabytes, each of which is a factor of 1,000 larger than the previous. Well, it's not going to be very long, maybe a year or two, before we start describing our hard disk spaces in terms of what's the next step. Terabytes. You know, this hard disk at 400 gigs is almost half a terabyte. And it's not very long ago that the FAS computer systems, these big systems to which many users could connect at once, their hard disks or their multiple hard disks were really themselves only about half a terabyte, which at the time sounded huge. But this is just a few years ago. Certainly home users are far outstripping those needs today. Well, RAM. Megabytes, gigabytes, terabytes, kilobytes? In what units are they measured? Yeah, so we're talking megabytes. How many megabytes? 512. It's a pretty good machine these days. Maybe 128. Might feel a little slow. Older machines, 64 megabytes, but you're really going to start to feel the slowdown there. You might have as much as maybe 1 gigabyte, which, just to be clear, is how many megabytes? Yeah, it's roughly 1,000. Specifically 1024, but roughly 1,000 megabytes. And then even these days on a home computer, if you've spent a few extra dollars, you might have 2 gigabytes. Beyond that, you're probably wasting your money because your computer simply can't take advantage of those kinds of resources. But we'll talk about everything collectively at the end of tonight's lecture. L2 cache. This is a type of memory. It's electronic. It's not something that you can sort of buy off the shelf and add to your computer because it's usually attached or soldered onto what device in the computer? Yeah, usually onto the motherboard or onto the CPU. Depends on the version of the computer you have. Size. Kilobytes, megabytes, gigabytes? Could be megabytes. You hedged there, and that's okay. You might see computers, particularly some Macs, with 1 megabyte of L2 cache, but more common is something slightly smaller. What might be smaller? Kilobytes. So maybe like 512 kilobytes, maybe 128 kilobytes, maybe 1 megabyte, maybe 2 megabytes, but an order of magnitude smaller than everything else we've seen. How about L1 cache? Kilobytes, megabytes, gigabytes? Yeah, it's really in kilobytes. How many usually? Yeah, 32, 64, pretty small amounts. 64 kilobytes, maybe 128, but again, all in that ballpark. Now the CPU, megabytes, kilobytes, gigabytes? Ooh, good. Trick question. It's measured in hertz, right? No longer are we talking about size, because that's not really applicable, at least in terms of storage capacity, because, yeah, it has registers, but we're talking bits in that case. But we do describe a CPU in terms of its speed. So if someone says, how fast is your computer, what they're specifically asking is, how fast is your CPU? And it's perhaps the primary determinant of the performance of your computer, at least the easiest one to slap a number on. But it turns out that all of these things together really actually affect your computer's overall feel or its overall speed. But what kinds of numbers are we talking here? 72 RPM actually goes over here. That was the speed of a hard drive. So let me make quick note of that, because we did discuss RPM, maybe 5,400 RPM, though those are tougher to find these days. That's just the speed, how fast the platters inside are spinning. And we'll look inside of a hard drive momentarily. But back here, at speed of a CPU is what? It is in hertz. Megahertz, and even more likely these days in gigahertz. How many gigahertz or megahertz?
1, 2, 3
Okay, so maybe 1 gigahertz, maybe 2 gigahertz. 3 gigahertz, maybe, what else might be reasonable, 800 megahertz. I mean, I still have a computer under my desk that's only, I think, 233 megahertz, but it gets the job done, frankly. So this kind of range. You see a bit of a wider range here, especially if the computer is older, but we're probably topping out around 1, 2, 3 gigahertz these days. Okay, so just to clarify, a hertz, what was a hertz? I mean, what are these units really measuring? Yeah, it's hertz is just 1/1 second. So it's how many things are going on per second. And when we talk about gigahertz, we're talking about how many billions of things can go on per second. And essentially, it's how fast the CPU is ticking, how fast the little oscillating crystal, to be exact, like a very fast and expensive wristwatch, maybe not expensive, but a very fast wristwatch is oscillating, and on every toll of that clock, something can happen. An addition can be performed, a subtraction can be performed, and so forth. So this was the pipeline. The numbers in terms of storage space are clearly decreasing as you move from right to left, but why? What was the motivation for these decreasing sizes in memory capacity? Yeah, it's speed. As you move from right to left in this diagram, all of these memory types are becoming faster, but you're paying more for it. And due to a variety of engineering techniques, it's okay if you have less of the faster memory, more of the slower memory, because very efficient algorithms can make sure that at least you're keeping the most expensive, fastest memory perpetually busy. In fact, because it goes faster, that's going to be a bit of a bottleneck. But it's OK because you can keep the memory filled, and you can keep instructions flowing into the CPU. Now, what else need we look at here? Well, just to toss out a bit of nomenclature, you might see in your readings two terms. One is called primary storage. One is called secondary storage. For the most part, secondary storage is just a buzzword describing anything from a hard drive on over this way. And now, clearly there's nothing over there, but there are things we could toss onto the board like CD-ROM drives, DVD-ROM drives, zip drive, words you've probably heard before, just other ways of storing data, but they're all secondary. Primary memory, by contrast, is RAM, L2, and L1 cache. So think of it essentially this way. Primary memory is essentially the volatile memories, the purely electronic stuff. Secondary storage is stuff that you don't lose data from if you pull the plug on your computer or shut it down. That's really the distinction. So with that said, let's focus on the biggest of these devices. This was a hard drive that I passed around last week. Question in back.
Is there a functional difference between L1 and L2 cache?
Is there a functional difference between L1 and L2 cache? No. One simply leads into the other. Good question. Is it enhancing RAM or is it enhancing what the CPU does? In a sense, it's both. RAM, though much faster than a hard disk, is slower in terms of speed than the CPU. It would be an unfortunate world if essentially you had a really fast worker communicating with a relatively slower worker. Better would be if you could put two other fast guys in between, the slow worker and the fast worker, so that, yeah, even if this guy takes a while to hand data to the faster guys, that is L1 and L2 cache, well, that's okay because that handing of data from RAM to cache can happen while the CPU is busy doing other things. So now you have data waiting for the CPU as soon as it's ready to process the next instructions. So that's essentially the way it works. So back to the hard drive in question. I pass this one around, and I will do this again. But let's actually take the cover off of this thing, both literally and digitally, by taking a look at the following brief video at the inside of your computer's hard drive, bearing in mind, of course, that this thing is entirely magnetic-based in terms of its storage, though it's obviously powered by electricity to spin.
The hard drive is where your PC stores most of its permanent data. To do that, the data travels from RAM along with software signals that tell the hard drive how to store that data. The hard drive circuits translate those signals into voltage fluctuations. These, in turn, control the hard drive's moving parts, some of the few moving parts left in the modern computer. Some of the signals control a motor which spins metal-coated platters. Your data is actually stored on these platters. Other signals move the read-write heads to read or write data on the platters. This machinery is so precise that human hair couldn't even pass between the heads and spinning platters. Yet, it all works at terrific speeds.
And the follow-up.
Let's look at what we just saw in slow motion. When a brief pulse of electricity is sent to the read-write head, it flips on a tiny electromagnet for a fraction of a second. The magnet creates a field, which changes the polarity of a tiny, tiny portion of the metal particles which coat each outer surface. A random series of these tiny charged up areas on the disk represents a single bit of data in the binary number system used by computers. Now, if the current is sent one way through the read-write head, the area is polarized in one direction. If the current is going in the opposite direction, the polarization is reversed. How do you get data off the hard disk? Just reverse the process. So it's the particles on the disk that get the current in the read-write head moving. Put together millions of these magnetized segments, and you've got a file. Now, the pieces of a single file may be scattered all over drive's platters, kind of like the best of papers on your desk. So a special extra file keeps track of where everything is. Don't you wish you had something like that?
Well, I feel like I always have to apologize to some extent for the videos we show in this class. But this is perhaps one of the coolest things we will pass around in tonight's lecture. This is a hard drive, just like the one we're passing around over there, but Ray has removed the lid of this hard drive using a special screwdriver, or just a regular screwdriver if it's an older drive, and what you see is exactly what the woman's voice just described inside of this hard drive. Notice that we have, in this case, two platters, suggesting that this drive is actually rather old. These days they have usually several more. You can see the phonograph-like reading head. You can also see and feel the fact that this thing is quite strong, the metal, and that's a good thing because spinning 7,200 times per minute, you don't want there to be any wobbling going on, especially as this reading head can gouge the inside of the disk, thereby rendering your data corrupted, getting in the way of not only the metal, but also just moving magnetic particles around. So imagine, if you will, if I were to drop this thing, what is it that breaks most likely if you drop your laptop or drop your computer? So the casing, though, this is pretty strong metal. The read head, the arm, most likely nothing will break off. Maybe a small wire or cable might break off, but more likely that impact hitting a carpeted or cement floor is enough to jar the drive, especially if it's on and moving, such that that reading head ever so briefly dips into the metal, gouging it, again, as I said, which really renders the disk rather corrupt. This might explain then, for instance, if you try to boot up a dropped laptop or boot up a dropped computer or a computer that's been jostled while it's been on, why maybe it kind of sort of works. Maybe Windows will start to come up, then it will crash. Maybe it won't load at all. Maybe you can put the hard drive in another computer, get your data off, but can't boot it into Windows. The reason being, well, maybe Windows was stored physically on the drive exactly where the drive was damaged, and maybe your data was on the other platter. You, the user, don't really know where the data is being stored, but that's the primary reason that drives get damaged. Or you can simply have some kind of mechanical failure, right? And inside of a computer, there's very few moving parts. One of the few things that's likely to go wrong, short of lightning striking your house or a component overheating, is that the parts just wear out. Spinning 7,200 times per minute for 3 years straight, a hard drive is perhaps one of the first, if only, things that's ever going to go. As such, the most important thing in a computer to, let's say, back up is probably what is sitting on your drive here, your data, namely. So let me pass this around, and let us consider for a moment now how we go from last week's incredibly low-level basics of bits and magnetic particles being aligned and these platters spinning to actually storing files, interesting files on your hard disk. Well, let's simplify our world for just a moment and suppose that a hard drive has just a single platter inside of it, and we'll draw it roughly as such. Well, when you store a file on your computer, you're going to take up some of the space on the surface area of that drive with the bits that comprise your file. Maybe your file is an email, maybe your file is your latest copy of your resume. So let's suppose for the moment that your resume is of a decent size, so it's going to fill up this portion of one of the platters. And by fill up, I mean all of these zeros and ones are now going to be allocated to that particular file. Well, elsewhere on the hard drive, elsewhere on a platter, is essentially, and we'll say arbitrarily that it's here, something called a file allocation table, or FAT, if you've seen the acronym before. And this is a relatively simple concept. It's sort of like an Excel spreadsheet with at least two columns, one of which might say resume dot doc, the other of which says what, do you think? Sorry? Perhaps the size, sure. What else? Yeah, the location. And I could actually make more columns and add things like size, all of which are relevant. But key to note is that it also stores the location, which might be at address, let's say, just to make it look complicated, we'll say it's at address 0x23. OX just denotes hexadecimal, which is a concept we'll come back to in our lecture on website development. For now, just assume that it's at location 23. And we're going to say arbitrarily that location 23 is right there. So now if I proceed to save another file, maybe a letter, home to my mother, calling it letter.doc, well, it might get stored at OX, say, 24. Because there happens to be some free space next to those bits on the hard drive. This then is going to be called location 24, and the zeros and ones that comprise my letter to my mother are going to get stored there on the disk. What happens now, and this is true in Windows and Mac OS and Linux, all of this stuff for the most part is platform independent. So what happens, do you think, when you delete a file from a hard drive? You drag your resume to the trash can or to the recycle bin. What happens to it? Ah, you would like to think that. You would like to think that the magnetic particles are rearranged, thereby obliterating your data, throwing it away in the truest sense. But in fact, that's not what happens. Sorry? Okay, they don't get stored somewhere else, fortunately. The computer, fortunately, doesn't just hide the bits on you. It does get rid of them in a sense, but in what sense, do you think? Yeah, that's in fact what it does. Nothing is touched here. This remains location 23. This remains location 24 conceptually. All of those zeros and ones that comprise the resume.doc stay there. All the computer, Windows, Mac OS, Linux do is forget where it is. And to do that, it suffices to just remove that row in the file allocation table. Now, the operating system, the software that runs on top of the computer, operating system for tonight's purposes, something like Windows, something like Mac OS. Yes, the resume is there, but now Windows and ergo you have no way of finding it, no way of getting to it. Now, how do you get this data back? Well, how many of you have heard of software like Norton Utilities? Okay, so Norton Utilities is a godsend for those of you who have thought to install it before you do something stupid, before you erase some file that you really need. And it does a variety of other things. And I, too, am guilty of this thinking, gee, maybe now or maybe yesterday would have been a good time to install Norton Utilities. Norton Utilities is a type of software made by a company called Symantec. There are other software packages that do this that allows you to unerase files. Now, how could that possibly be? Well, the caveat is you must have unerase utilities like Norton installed in advance of a screw-up or in advance of you losing a file. But how do you think, given this picture of our world, such programs work and actually unerase files? Okay, repositioning, maybe moving the file to some other place. Quite possible, but we can do it even more simply than that. Yeah. Yeah, pretty much. What Norton utilities and any unerase utility generally do is simply keep a backup of the file allocation table. Anytime you make changes to it, Norton says, oh, wait, Windows, let me make a note of what you're erasing. And it simply remembers that resume.doc was at one point in time at location 23. Now, programs like Norton, when you go through the various menu options and say, I really want to unerase resume.doc, they'll typically give you a percentage next to the file in this little graphical user interface that says, all right, David, I can recover this file with 80% probability. Or to be more exact, I can recover 80% of this file. Now, the more time you wait before trying to unerase a file, the lower that percentage tends to become. In other words, if I wait 2 months, having deleted my resume 2 months ago, and now, gee, I really would like to get that back, Norton or a program like it might say, all right, David, I can give it back to you, but only 25% of your file. Now, why technically do you think that might be? Yeah, that's the problem. Even though when you erase a file, you leave the bits there, you're now telling the operating system, reuse that space at will. Now, by chance, it's possible that the operating system might not get around to reusing this part of the disk. Maybe the next 20 files you create end up here, 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 and so forth. And just by chance, these bits are never reused. But if they are eventually reused, in other words, let's erase the conceptual border that we put around those bits. Those bits are still there. But suppose the 21st file that I try creating after deleting my resume happens to take up this space, and it's a big file, this space as well. All of its zeros and ones end up here. They overwrite these zeros and ones with their own zeros and ones. Now, this section still contains what? Yeah, part of my resume, but maybe 25% of my resume. So maybe Norton can recover part of your file. What does it mean to recover part of a file? Well, when you double click it or open it in like Microsoft Word, you might see a lot of junk, and then some of the sentences you had in your resume, you might see complete junk, meaning just the useful part of your resume happened to be stored up here. It really depends. But you'll have a file that Norton says, this is what's there now. Sort of up to you to salvage as much of the data by highlighting and copying and pasting, perhaps, as you possibly can.
If this is off topic, just ignore it. But sure. It comes to mind that I remember hearing about companies that can get all of your data from whenever. And it's really expensive, and it's kind of like, or it's even like searching into old files that are top secret and that kind of thing. I'm just wondering. But this is really true.
False advertising. The question for those of you at home is, some companies claim to be able to recover any and all of your data no matter how much time has passed. It's an overstatement. The short answer is that using a variety of software packages or just people who know how to write such software, you can typically recover a huge amount of data from someone's hard drive. Realistically, though, any data that has been overwritten, such as in this case, not even if you pay the company $2,000 are they likely to get that data back for you. In fact, as an aside to this, one of the research projects that I'm working on this year with a gentleman from MIT is precisely this problem in assessing the claim that has been made for years in movies and in literature and people off the cuff saying, well, yeah, maybe these private companies can't get back even my whole resume, but you know, maybe the NSA, if they really wanted to get this data back, they could crack open the hard drive, as Ray did in this case, could take something like an electron microscope or an oscilloscope and could figure out what bits used to be there in hopes that, yeah, even though the bits have been realigned now, maybe we can tell by whatever residue is on the disk where they were previously aligned. But the fact of the matter is, it's a bit of an old wives' tale, at least, has yet to be demonstrated in any published literature that that's even possible. However, absolutely could a company recover these bits from your data. And in fact, what you can do, and we'll talk about this in greater detail in our security lectures, is there is a ridiculous amount of data available on your hard drive. And as some of you know, I actually work as an aside for the district attorney's office in Middlesex County doing exactly these kinds of forensic analyses. And I can tell you firsthand that it is remarkable how much data is actually lingering on people's, we call them suspects, hard drives. Another good question. So there do exist products that claim to be able to erase data beyond recovery, and they work typically by, for instance, when I delete resume.doc, they allow Windows to remove the FAT entry, but they then go ahead and take the trouble of overwriting that portion of the disk with, say, random data so that it's just garbage, or maybe with all zeros. Programs like that, and there's a number of them out there, and we'll talk about this again in our security lectures, they do work sometimes. The fact of the matter is a lot of these commercial products that you'll pay $19.95 for, $99.95 for, are broken. And it's only by actually performing forensic analyses of the drives can you actually determine how and in what ways those programs have failed you. So the short answer is, yes, they're better to use than nothing, but there are a lot of lingering pieces of data lying around a hard drive. And the kinds of things you can recover, just again as a teaser for our security lectures, are things like someone's internet history. You can typically recover most every picture, most every URL that a user has visited, even if they've gone up to the the tools menu in Internet Explorer and said selected clear history or empty cache. Most of that data is actually still there because of this technical underpinning. They're erased only in the sense of they're forgotten. They are not wiped out. Even if you format a drive, that is perhaps one of the biggest lies in the Windows world. If you've ever formatted a drive, you've probably seen an error message, a warning message that says, warning, this will erase all of your data. Mm-mm. Erases this, leaving almost all of this intact. Question here.
So when you donate an old computer to the scouts, your stuff is still potentially there.
Yes, in fact, and we'll distribute this again in our security lectures. I'm realizing maybe next year we'll start with Introduction to Security and punt hardware to who cares how it works? How do you get your data off of it? Yes, in fact, there have been a number of studies done that demonstrate just how scary it is, how much data is floating around there. And you can do this as an experiment yourself. Buy a few hard drives off of eBay, run some off-the-shelf forensic software, and you'll see what data has actually been left there. And the sad thing is, part of it is a problem of user education. Users think, when Microsoft tells them, all your data will be erased, all my data will be erased. Unfortunately, they're taking liberties with the term erased and all. Question in back.
In terms of recovery, isn't it a function then of how much the computer can use to actually determine how much it overwrites?
Yes. Yes. So when I said earlier that the amount of data that's still recoverable is a function of time, that's true in that I'm assuming that you're using the computer over that amount of time. So if you go crazy one night, desperately trying to overwrite previously written data by downloading every MP3 you can possibly find so that you fill up all of the available space on your hard drive, probabilistically you're going to clobber your resume in its entirety. However, there are more simple ways of doing that, as with the erasure software you cited. Question?
What is the point of just erasing it from that square line? Why didn't they just when you erase it, erase it? Why didn't they just
It's a good question. Why has erase for 10, 15 years typically meant just unlinking the file from the file allocation table and not actually overwriting the bits? Let me push this back out to the audience. Why do you think this has been the case? Easier is, frankly, an incredibly reasonable answer. It's easier, and relatedly, it's faster. I mean, just think how quickly you can delete files if all you're doing is erasing that entry. And that's a useful thing, certainly for users who prioritize the speed of their computers.
Is it like if you go to the spreadsheet, how to find the name, and if you get some data?
So if you lay the data out more cleverly? Mm-hmm.
So that it will like search it and not like stop at certain points and stuff.
So I somewhat follow your point, but I'm not sure if it's quite an answer to the question why have companies not just implemented delete
right.
as you would expect.
But it makes searching more efficient.
Oh, I see. But only if you care about searching data that was once there and data that's not currently there. So I'm not quite sure if that's germane. Response? Yeah, so it has been claimed, truthfully or not, that users actually like the fact that there is a fallback in the event you accidentally erase some file, in the event you have some disk trouble. Yeah, it's been erased, but still with a bit of effort, money, time, dedication, I can get it back. Now, perhaps that's a bit of a rationalization from the guy who did not implement erase correctly, but there's something to be said for that. I think the fact of the matter is, it's not until quite recently that the world has actually started caring about security and caring about privacy that really best explains the matter. Customers, government, personal, and institutions simply have not been demanding the level of security that I think you're hearing people now clamor for. And frankly, I think it's as simple as that. It simply wasn't a high priority feature to make things secure.
So if you had someone that you really wanted to erase, could you get them to the computer and rub a magnet over it?
Good question. If you had something you really wanted to erase, could you just rub a big magnet over it? Yes, you could. That could actually damage the drive permanently, which might be acceptable as well, running a high-powered magnet over it. It could work. Frankly, the best way, for those of you who have some work to do this weekend, is to throw the hard drive in the furnace or to take it to a machine shop that punches holes through the platters and generally renders the drive completely inaccessible.
So water doesn't destroy
it? Water. Water could begin to corrode it. It depends how long the water sits there. It depends on what is in the water. There have been cases cited, truthfully or not, such as companies that do data recovery professionally that will recover data even if it's been, you know, lost on a shipwrecked boat. They claim to have repaired things like this. Typically, I think the answer is a probabilistic one. You can get back some, most of the data if there's been water damage, but not all. But I would not dispose of your data just by running it under a faucet, particularly as these things, for the most part, are vacuum sealed. So you'd first have to at least crack it open. Fire, to be honest, is perhaps the most effective way of getting rid of data beyond the software-based tools. The fact of the matter is there are some software-based tools that do work quite well. You can use the drive after and don't have to buy a new hard drive every time you've visited certain websites. Or stored particularly confidential information on your hard drives. But there are a variety of ways that you can do this. And actually, to the question earlier, why has there been such disregard for this notion of security? I mean, think back just 10 or so years when cell phones first came out. In the analog cell phone world, and by analog I mean the types of phones that were, one, this big and also tended to have a lot of static, those cell phones worked essentially by when you hit send, it broadcast its unique ID, 1234, to the nearest cell phone tower. The cell phone tower said, oh, I'm getting a call from user 1234, I'm going to therefore bill user 1234 and then connect their call. Well, this is why people 10 years ago were so easily hijacking people's phones and stealing other people's cell phone service. There was absolutely no security, no regard for security given to that technology. It was literally as trivial as broadcasting publicly the user's ID number, then connecting the call. And now the assumption there was, well, who's going to know how to figure out how to sniff the airwaves? Well, it just takes one guy. And these days it takes one guy with an internet connection and a blog to propagate that information. So it's happened in all industries. Question here.
How long can you
keep the data?
If you have a hard drive, have they any idea how long the data will stay?
Oh, in terms of years and so forth? I don't think many good studies have occurred with that because if you put a hard drive on the shelf for 20 years, it's actually would be huge, and it would be very old technology at this point. I suspect manufacturers rate their hard drives typically. I mean, you can kind of get a sense of, you can look at the warranties and get a sense of how likely the drive is to fail. Usually drive manufacturers these days only warranty them for 1 year, even though that's quite lowballing the lifetime. What's more likely to happen over time is that the mechanics just stop working. The data might remain intact on the platters, and if you pay someone enough money, they could take the hard drive apart in a very clean laboratory environment, replace the reading head, replace some of the circuitry, and then vacuum seal things back up and get the data off. But no good studies that I know of have actually said, you know, a hard drive is good for 22 years on average. They simply have not been around in their present form long enough. But it's a good question, especially as so much of our world turns digital and you're storing things like library volumes and so forth on disks. It'd be nice to know how long they're going to actually stay intact. Other questions? Yeah?
Once we format our hard drive, is there any way we can retrieve data after we install a new operating system?
Good question. Once you format your hard drive and install a new operating system on it, can you get back that data? The short answer is yes. The software with which you can recover data forensically, essentially, tends to be somewhat expensive because it's a rather bit of a niche market. You, the home user, you could probably Google around, frankly, and find free utilities that particularly can find specific files. It's relatively easy, for instance, to write a program that looks through your whole hard drive looking for JPEGs, graphic files, looking for Microsoft Word documents or Excel documents, because all of these files, even if their contents are different, do share a common structure, and you can detect that structure. So the short answer is you can get most of your data back, but with effort, time, or money. Other questions? Well, let's take a look at everything that I promised would be over here in the realm of secondary storage, starting with perhaps technology that's been around for a while, both in your living rooms and now in your computers, and that is a CD-ROM drive or CD reader. Well, just generally speaking, in layman's terms, how do CDs, CD drives, CD players, CD-ROM drives work? Okay, you turn them on. You took quite literally our final video from last week. Okay, so I've turned my CD player on in my stereo system. I put in my CD. How does stuff play off of that? How is it stored?
Does it work similar to the CD in
your computer? It works identically to the CD in your computer. The technologies are a little different. Just the layout of the bits on CDs, ROMs versus CDs is a little different. So how does it work? I mean, this is the DVD. DVDs work almost exactly the same way as CDs, just with slightly more advanced technology. Here's a DVD or CD. If I didn't show you the other side and pull it out of a DVD player, I could tell you this was a CD. They look the same. I mean, I can touch this, foolishly, but I can touch it. I have not destroyed next week's lecture, fortunately. Why? It's read with a beam. What kind of beam? Yeah, it's a laser beam. So just as in the world of floppy disks and in hard drives, you're storing data at the end of the day as zeros and ones, but not with magnetic particles. Even if I run my whole hand over this, I might get some oils from my hands which could interfere with the playing of the disk, but I'm not likely destroying any data because the data on a CD or a DVD is actually stored by way of what are called pits and lands, essentially indentations on the disk, whereby we can assume for now that if you burn a slight hole or indentation into the disk, you've just represented a 1. And if there's no such hole present, then you've just represented a 0. And let's take a look at this on the overhead to make it a little more real.
A CD-ROM disk holds so much more than a conventional disk. The CD drive reads data with a beam of light so narrow that the information can be squeezed together much tighter. You see, a laser diode creates this concentrated beam of light. The light travels through a prism. Then, through a lens and magnetic coil that focuses the beam even more. On the underside of the compact disk itself are millions of tiny bumps called pits. That's right, the bumps are called pits.
The same surface has smooth areas called lands. These pits and lands are translated into the binary language of bits and bytes used by the computer.
And the follow-up in a bit more detail.
Patterns of pits and lands are laid out along a continuous spiral. As the disc turns, a precise motor keeps the laser beam in place on the pad. Where the laser beam hits a pit, the light is scattered. But where it hits a land, the beam is reflected straight back along its original path. The light enters the prism again, but this time it is reflected at a 90-degree angle and strikes a device called a diode. The diode creates an electric pulse each time the light hits it. So when the laser hits a pit, no light bounces back. When it strikes a land, the diode sees the reflection and sends a pulse. These lengths and pulses are sent to the computer, which interprets them as a pattern of zeros and ones. In other words, into binary code.
So now let's bring this back into the realm of common day use. If we're talking about a typical CD-ROM disk, such as the one that you might have bought Adobe Photoshop on, Microsoft Word on, anything that stores data in the form of a CD, how much stuff can fit onto one of these disks? How many bytes? Well, let's start ballpark. Megabytes, gigabytes, terabytes, kilobytes? Okay, megabytes. Now, how many megabytes? It's almost 800. Tends to be about 650 to 700 megabytes. So 650 to 700 megabytes fits on a typical CD-ROM. In fact, that's about as much data as also fits on a typical CD, an audio CD that you might play in your stereo system, which suggests, if we ballpark this, that maybe on an average CD that you might buy from the music store, maybe it has 10 songs on it. So roughly then, how big are each of the files representing a song on your audio CD taking up? Yeah, maybe like 60 megabytes, 70 megabytes, if you just divide that by 10. Now, that's pretty big. Contrast this with, and let's fast forward briefly to our multimedia lecture, in which we'll talk about MP3s, which is a file format many of you are probably familiar with, downloadable songs, iPods, and so forth. Our podcast, for instance, is accessible in MP3 format. When you download an MP3, legally, let's say, how big does it tend to be? Sorry? It's not in gigabytes. That would actually take quite a while these days. It's quite small relative to the sizes we just mentioned. A typical MP3 might be 3 megabytes, 4 megabytes. Can be downloaded relatively quickly, even on a slow connection these days. But notice the order of magnitude difference. An MP3 for a song tends to take up, for simplicity, let's say max 6 megabytes. The corresponding song on an audio CD that you might buy from the store takes up 60 megabytes. So that suggests that this MP3 file format is quite compressed. And that's been one of its selling points because to the human ear, to many human ears, they're actually pretty indistinguishable, whether you're listening to the original CD on your sound system or you're listening to the MP3 through a good computer system. But we'll come back to that in our multimedia lecture. That's why MP3s are able to stream more easily, more efficiently. You could do it with other formats, but you would need faster download capacities. Yeah?
I'm sorry, I just didn't catch it.
LAND, pits and lands. So holes and bumps, valleys and hills. All right, how about a DVD or DVD-ROM? The difference being the first is one that you would rent from Blockbuster and watch. DVD-ROM is one that they might ship you software on. How much space is available on a typical DVD disc? A gigabyte? It's right ballpark, but a bit more. 3 gig, a little more. roughly, on a standard DVD, 4.7 gigabytes. However, there are also versions of DVDs that go up to roughly 8 gigabytes. And within a year, probably, there will be even fancier DVDs. You may have read of the debate in the industry between Sony's Blu-ray DVD format and the other format, whose name I forget.
It's Toshiba HD DVD.
HD DVD is the competing format. It remains to be seen in the next year or so which format beats out the other one. They have slightly different storage capacities, both of which are much bigger than 8 gigabytes. So we'll finally move away from this silly world in which when you rent or buy Lord of the Rings, you don't have to switch the discs halfway through the movie. You'll actually be able to fit the whole movie on a single disc. But that's roughly the storage capacity. And again, order of magnitude difference. But how much bigger physically is a DVD versus a CD? It must be huge, right? They're the same. So how can that possibly be? There's compression going on. There's more pits and lands. Looking at it from a physical perspective, the picture is exactly the same in principle, but those pits and lands are closer together. The laser beam being used is narrower. So the technology fundamentally is the same, but it's simply doing things much more efficiently. Now, what about these rewritable technologies these days? You might have heard of things like CDRs or CDRWs, the first one of which is CD recordable, which means you can burn, quote unquote, that is write, save data onto the disk, but only once. And you have to decide in advance what you're putting on it, because you can only write the data once. A CDRW is CD rewritable, which means you can change it. You can add stuff after you've burned the disk. These storage capacities are the same, 650 to 700 megabytes. You can even buy these kinds of disks in like CVS across the street these days. They are used so that people can burn their own audio CDs, and they are used so that people can burn their own data CDs. For instance, storing a whole lot of photographs or documents, maybe a backup of your hard drive onto one or more CDs is a use. Also just burning mixes like people used to with mixed cassette tapes. You can do that these days with writable CDs. But this technology, then, is quite possible in, you know, a laptop today, in a desktop computer. You don't need a whole factory to produce these pits and lands. Now, does a CD look any, a CDR or CDRW, so far as you know, look any different from this? Not really. It's the same size. It spins in the same way. It's read by the same kind of laser. But the difference is, rather than essentially etching bumps and hills into the face of the CD, a CDR and CDRW makes use of a special type of film, and that's what gives them their color typically. They're typically greenish or bluish or goldish. That's essentially a type of film that when the laser is trying to write data, it distorts the film that's underneath the plastic casing that is the CDR or the CDRW in such a way that now, if you've distorted that film in one location, rather than the laser beam bouncing off the disk and bouncing right back, being readable, therefore, by the laser technology, it gets distorted and sent off elsewhere. So if there's a distortion, you can think of a 1 as having been stored. But if the light bounces right back because there is no such distortion, it's, say, a 0. CDRWs work exactly the same way, but the disk itself is made out of a material that you can reverse this process. You can distort the material in one way, and then you can undistort it effectively to change that back to a 0 if you wanted to change data or add data to the disk. DVD-Rs, DVD-RWs work in principle exactly the same way. And unfortunately, one of the most confusing things about this particular world of optical storage, as it's called, optical suggesting the use of light, laser beams, is that in the DVD world, you also see things like DVD plus R, DVD plus RW. These are just, sadly, different standards for storing data. My experience and research has been such that if you have to make a consumer decision, the DVD dash R or RW tends to be the more universally accepted standard. Most drives these days, though, when you buy one, typically support all of these, so it's almost a non-issue these days. But you do need to realize that if you try to play a new technology, like a new DVD RW, in an older machine, it might not work. It might not understand. In fact, I recently got a new DVD player to put underneath my TV in my living room. For one reason, because it was my old one. It's a nice DVD player, a Sony DVD player, but it was several years old. Maybe I bought it in 1999, 2000, not a huge amount of time ago. But CDRs did not exist at the time. which meant that if I wanted to play some mix CD that I had made or a friend had made in my home stereo system using my DVD player, I couldn't do it. Technology worked to make the disc, but my drive was too old to understand it. You run into the same issue if you have an older CD player in your car and you try to play a recordable CD, a mix of songs that someone has burned for you. Some car stereo systems don't understand it. So in short, the newer the hardware in your computer or in your living room, the more likely it is to be able to run any type of CD or DVD on the market today. But if it doesn't, it just might mean that it's too old or there's a problem with the disc physically. Question, and then there. Is there a difference between minus or plus R between PC Mac? No. In fact, what do Macs use predominantly? They use minus R, typically. Fundamental? No. It's just different standards, similar in spirit to the current debate over the new DVD format. Simply different companies have invented different standards, much to the disappointment of consumers. Question? What is the difference between CD and CD-ROM? In conversation, none, really. CD-ROM, though, specifically means read-only memory. However, you can't change the contents of a music CD either. So generally, CD-ROM is the term used for a CD in the computer world. A CD, by itself, is the music world. But it's an uninteresting distinction these days. I don't know offhand, actually, which one came out more recently, but they've long been competing with each other. And frankly, we're in a happy state of the world now because most drives do support all of them. Yeah?
Are people talking about optical storage instead of magnetic storage on computer hard drives?
No. Optical storage is even slower in terms of performance than a hard drive, for one, because you don't have this vacuum-sealed environment at which you can spin as quickly. The magnetic technology happens to be more quick, typically, at least in this world. So what you're actually seeing now is a move to what's called solid-state memory, flash devices, such as the new iPod Nano. There are no moving parts in the iPod Nano except for the buttons that you can push because everything is stored electronically, but in a non-volatile way. So the world has gotten to the point where, like the CMOS on your motherboard, the settings get saved, the MP3s get saved, even after you remove electricity. So frankly, I think over the next few years, you'll see more devices with solid state or flash memory than you will with moving parts like these. Let's take a 5-minute break. Okay. Welcome back, and we had a couple of questions. Yes. Those of you who were not here last week, the question is about books. If you're looking just to get, for instance, a single book, I would go with The Computers Are Your Future, 2006. It's the closest thing to a overarching textbook for the course. Other Computers Are Your Future, 2006. It's the very first one listed on the syllabus under the book section. Being demonstrated here. And again, shop online if you're savvy with online purchasing rather than at the Coop, and you'll save yourself several dollars. Several dollars. Other questions? Yeah? Good question. Because CDs, DVDs work relatively similarly. Can you get one drive that does everything? Yes. In fact, they're often called combo drives in layman's terms, or they are called CD/CDR/DVD/DVDR. Everything is just listed in the description of the drive, and they do everything. In fact, these days, for just $50 or fewer, you can get something that reads and writes pretty much every type of CD and every type of DVD. Other questions? No? Well, then two quick announcements. We have coming up tonight and this coming Saturday, Section 1, which is entitled Dissecting a PC. This is an incredibly fun way to begin the section agendas, to be honest. You will literally not just pass around pieces of hardware that I have pre-dissected for you, but rather you will take some fully operational and fully intact computers and with the teaching fellows and a few screwdrivers begin to dissect the computer, not just taking it apart for the sake of taking it apart, but for discussing all of the various components, seeing for yourself how everything fits in. Where does the hard drive connect? What is the motherboard? Where is the ROM? Where do I add the RAM? All of these are the kinds of questions and topics that you will look like in section beginning tonight, right after lecture, if you're in the Thursday section, or in the Saturday section this coming weekend. In fact, also on Saturday is the first of our workshops, Workshop 1. Using a computer, using a PC in the course's website. This is meant for those of you who really would like a gentle introduction to the course, but really to computing in general. This is not the sort of class that those of you who feel yourself quite savvy with computers but are just missing some conceptual holes would probably get much out of, because this is really intended to be for the true newbie in the course, or for those of you that really have no idea what I mean by a podcast or a video, but you would very much like to learn how to listen to such or to watch such on your computer. So the purpose of the workshop is twofold. One, really acclimate even the most timid of users to just the PC environment as best we can in just a couple of hours, and two, introduce those of you, savvy or otherwise, to how to watch the videos, how to download the podcasts. And that's this Saturday. Schedule, location, time, everything on the course's website and in the syllabus.
Sorry, this probably hasn't been asked before, but is there flexibility?
Good question. If you're unable to make your regularly assigned section, for instance a Thursday, can you attend the other? Absolutely. I would just ask that you drop the teaching fellows a note at the course's email address just to make sure that there's going to be a computer for you, but that should not be a problem. Other questions? All right. So that's pretty much the state of the world in optical technology. For those of you who might want to play with some of the videos that I displayed earlier, and there's a couple of others that I've put in the account, they'll be linked on the course's website after tonight, and you can look at them online. But let's take a step back to one other issue related to hard drives, because it's a question that usually comes up, and I was hoping it would come from you, but I think once I ask it, you'll maybe nod and say, oh, that's a good question, David. The question is, should I, and how often should I, defragment my hard drive? So first of all, how many of you understood that sentence? Okay, so what does it mean to defragment a hard drive? Yeah. To organize. Be more specific, more technical. Okay, good. So to store, I'll reword if I may, to store on disk all of your files and folders as contiguously, physically as possible. In other words, all of the bits that comprise your resume ideally should be situated in the same location so that when the reading head passes over them, it gets all of the files bits at once. Well, why would you even need to defragment your hard drive? In other words, why would your hard drive get fragmented in the first place? True. You would do it to improve performance, but why do you need to do it? How do you get yourself into this state of the world in which files and folders are fragmented? Yeah?
Well, when it stores it, it doesn't necessarily store it in consecutive places. Sometimes a single file will store it in many different locations.
That's very true. So for simplicity, I put my resume and my second file contiguous on the disk. I put the first one here and the second one there because there was so much free space on the disk. But suppose that there's not so much free space in such a way that the computer can plop your file wherever, but there's very little. And this is my the extent of my artistic abilities, as you'll see this semester. This, again, is a hard drive platter, just one for now. All of the shaded area means bits are being used there. Zeros and ones are important. They belong to files. And the disk is obviously very full. But suppose to free up some space, because Windows or Mac OS is yelling at me that I need to free up some space, I delete some big files in such a way that this big file is now removed from the fat. The bits are still there, but we'll erase the shading to suggest that now these bits are available for reuse. All of the magnetic particles are unallocated. And suppose that I happen to erase this file. So now the disk is still pretty full, but I've definitely got a few megabytes free now, let's say. Now suppose I want to download or create a file that, to scale, is maybe takes up this much space. Okay, so a pretty big file. Unfortunately, there's no opening in the hard disk big enough. You know, maybe if I deleted this file, I could fit this new file on the hard drive, but as such, Doesn't seem so. But what if I split this thing roughly in half, put half of the bits here, half of the bits here, did something clever with the file allocation table to say, yeah, the file starts at this location, but half of it is at this location. That's a reasonable thing to concoct. I did say that the fat is a little more involved than the two columns that I drew. So this is precisely what operating systems today do. It will try to make use of every available chunk of space on the hard disk, even if that means, quote unquote, fragmenting the file. The more you use your computer, the more deletes and creations of files that occur, the more fragmented your hard disk gets. Now, the files being deleted quite often aren't even ones that you're dragging to the recycle or trash bin. Just think of when you pull up your browser. As I said earlier, you can typically recover, given enough amount of time and effort, almost every graphic you've ever looked at, assuming they haven't been overwritten by new graphics. That's because programs like Internet Explorer, Netscape, Microsoft Word, Outlook, all of these programs maintain what are called temporary files. They're not typically plopped right on your desktop where you can see them. They're typically put in a folder tucked away somewhere where you don't see them as a human, but they're there. The implication is that there are a lot of holes, a lot of space that opens up in random places on your hard drive because other programs besides your own are actually doing things with the disk. So the implication earlier was that if you fragment this file by putting half here, half there, well, what did you just do to the performance of your computer when you're trying to use that file? Right, it's slow now because the reading head now has to seek, as is the verb, to this location. Then it needs to move to this location. Essentially, now you've done twice as much work to get at the same data. The implication then is that the more fragmented your hard drive, the more fragmented your hard drive, the slower might be its performance. So built into Windows is a little program called Disk Defragmenter. You can get to this on a Windows machine by going to the Start menu, Programs, Accessories, System Tools, I believe. This is the kind of window you would see, and this is sort of a user-friendly graphical depiction of a fragmented hard drive. We seem to have, at the top, a hard drive called Utils. It happens to be my E drive, as is the convention in the Windows world. Notice that the analysis display, the first colorful bar, horizontal bar, has a lot of vertical lines in it. Some red over to the right, there's some green at left, a lot of blue, but generally it gets pretty messy. That's simply this program's way of suggesting that there's a lot of fragmentation. Each different color belongs to a different file, essentially. So the more randomly scattered all of these different colors are, the more fragmented your hard drive is suggested to be. And we see that this drive is how big of a drive, incidentally. This is an old hard drive. Yeah, it's tough to see from back, but in under capacity, which is the fourth column, it says 8,189 megabytes. So that is a relatively small hard drive. In fact, it's probably a partition, but more on that in the future. Yeah?
You're saving something to your hard drive, and you had previously deleted a file.
Mm-hmm. Good question. When you delete a file, thereby freeing space, and try to create new files, does Windows or Mac OS like to use the once used space or the new space? The short answer is that it depends. Studies have suggested that it tends to reuse the once used space, thereby leaving a lot of the drive in a pristine state. But it really depends, arguably, on the version of Windows and on the types of what are called device drivers are installed on the system. So don't rely on any assumption there. Question here, and then here.
So you run a program that goes in and cleans your temp file.
Okay.
Does that also erase what you were talking about?
Good question. So if you run one of these wipe utilities, as they're typically called, or scrub utilities, which delete all of your temp files, internet files, and so forth, does it handle the fragmentation? Sort of two different issues, because all of the files, though fragmented, all of those bits belong to the same files, and you probably don't want to scrub useful files. However, if the temp files themselves are fragmented, absolutely, the scrub programs will get them no matter where they are on disk. For instance, if this is a temp file you're trying to erase, the scrub program doesn't even know that it's fragmented. That's a detail that macOS or Windows hides from it, so it will get scrubbed correctly, assuming the program's not buggy, to be frank. Question?
Do you have any control over where you put your storage?
Do you have any control over where you put your storage? No.
So why is it like water? The easy way out is it flows the easiest way? Is that it? Why would it store so fragmentedly?
Well, ideally it only stores it in a fragmented fashion when it has to, when there is no spot big enough to fit the new file, in which case fragmentation is necessary. Ideal would be a world in which the fragmentation does not occur. However, realize that our view of this world is still somewhat simplified. You saw even in the hard drive being passed around, there's how many platters in that thing? There were two platters. So really, there's two layers to this. Typically, there's two reading heads or sometimes three or four reading heads that read all four platters or five platters at once. It turns out that some very smart people have figured out how to lay out data in particularly optimal ways. So though I draw one file as being just on the top platter, all contiguous, it might be better physically to fragment that file, some on the top platter, some on the next platter, some on the next platter, and so forth, so that when you read the file, you're reading all of the file at once, but using all of the available reading heads. So fragmentation, in a sense, is not necessarily a bad thing, but what programs like this do is typically get rid of the bad type of fragmentation, which is fragmentation that is not designed to be more efficient for the hard drive's sake. Now, the question then we began with was, how often should you do this? Frankly, I have not once in 5 years defragmented my hard drive. Personally, I think it is of questionable value these days, no matter what the numbers suggest and no matter how fragmented the drive is, because there are other bottlenecks in computers these days. Hard drives have gotten relatively fast. They're still spinning at the same speed, but they come with special memory attached to them called cache. They come with relatively fast reading heads, which move ever more quickly. And personally, and the TFs can disagree in section if they'd like with me, I have never seen a human noticeable difference by defragmenting a modern hard drive. With older machines, my machine 6 years ago, yes, I definitely felt a difference. These days, I just don't think it is worth the time or effort. But decide for yourselves. Questions? Ooh, okay. Yes, here first. Can you stop the process in the middle? You can click stop. hopefully it will work well. I would not pull the plug or let your electricity go out, because when you hit stop, presumably the program doesn't just abort suddenly. It finishes whatever file it's working on. So yes, you can stop if the software is written well. In this case, I'd probably trust it. But frankly, I'd again never run it. So, question. Sure. It's under the Start menu, Programs, Accessories, System Tools. And in answer to your first question, I would say, just making this up, if your drive is smaller than 2 gigs or smaller than 4 gigs, you might feel benefits of this. Otherwise, I would not fret it. It's defragmenting hard on the computer. It's hard only in the sense that you are pretty much touching every location on the disk, at least every location that actually has data on it already. It's bad only in the sense that it's more wear and tear on your hard drive. I mean, if you're doing this every day, it's probably not ideal. If you're doing it once in a while, your hard drive, I mean, I haven't turned off my hard drive or computer in 2 years. So they can take it to some extent. I would disagree. I see no value to it. Again, some of this is just personal opinion, but it's not anything I've ever done recently. Yeah?
When you defrag your hard drive, does that update your application?
Great question. When you defrag, your hard drive is the fat being updated, absolutely, because the defragmentation process, by definition, may move some files to a completely different location of the hard drive, so they are designed to interact well with something like the fat, and yes, it does get updated correctly. Yeah?
You mentioned the kit you had to kind of gear up for 2 years. I was wondering, some people say it's better to leave it on, or some people say it's better to turn it off if you're not using it after 24 hours or so. And they say because of the gravity and cooling and the circuitry, is there any
So that's a really good question. How often should you leave your, is it better to leave your computer on all the time, or should you shut it down when you're done with it? From an environmental standpoint, you should shut it down at the end of the night. It is a waste of electricity. However, if you are letting it go into sleep mode, whereby the monitor clicks off, maybe the hard drives spin down, quote unquote, which means they stop spinning when you're not using them, it goes into a relatively low power state, which may be equivalent, though I'd have to look up the numbers, equivalent to like your clock radio being on 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. But from a power perspective, probably not ideal. From a hardware perspective, it's really not an issue these days. Yes, it is true that when you turn the power off and thereafter turn it back on, you're getting a surge of electricity very suddenly through those electrical circuits. And over time, if you do that enough, they will wear out. However, we are talking many more years than you would probably use the computer for, so I would not fret over turning your computer off every night and turning it on in the morning. I don't think it's an issue these days. Other questions? All of them good. The more deletions you make, the more it slows down the computer in principle, only because you're now leaving holes throughout the hard drive, which means future files may very well be fragmented, which means accessing them takes longer. Because there are other bottlenecks in the computer is the short answer. Because hard drives are so relatively fast these days, yes, it might take nanoseconds longer, milliseconds longer, but nothing that you, the human, are likely to see unless the drive is just ridiculously fragmented. But again, I think these days with modern hardware and speeds, yes, it's absolutely slowing it down, but not to an extent that most humans would notice. Usually, yes.
Why does it shoot it all the way down the pipeline to your hard drive instead of just dealing with it in RAM and then, you know, it's done with it and it never gets stored?
So the question is, why do browsers these days cache, as is the verb, most data to your hard drive? The short answer is for your benefit, because many times people like to click back, they like to click forward, they like to pull up the web page the next day. It is a useful thing if the data is already sitting there on your hard drive so that you're not constantly requesting the data again off of the internet. These days, it's a little bit less of an issue because most people are no longer using dial-up. More people are on broadband connections, which we'll discuss in 2 weeks, which are just faster. So again, humans, yeah, it's taking longer to go get the new data every time you visit a page, but it's happening so fast you don't really notice or care. But the motivation has been, why bother going out to the network, going requesting data from CNN.com in California if it hasn't changed in the past 60 seconds, therefore just let the local copy sit. So in short, it was meant as an optimization for efficiency reasons. Okay. Well, let's forge ahead, unless there are questions on fragmentation or hard disks or optical storage specifically. All right. So we come back now to the central artery system that is the computer. We look now at where all of this connects. And for those of you who would like...
What is PDA?
A PDA is a personal digital assistant, like something like a Palm Pilot or a RIM device or a Trio device. And let me fast forward through these slides. These are just closer lookups if you'd like to look at them later with more technical detail as to what we looked at. This, for instance, puts names to all of those films that I described as being on the discs, polycarbonate plastic. Not terribly interesting. But here we have the motherboard from last week. So we have a couple of them here, which I'll pass around. Just beware your fingers, since the solderings on the bottom can hurt a little bit. So the central artery system of the computer, we said. What goes in this square area. So that's the CPU. That's the brains. Here went RAM, we said. And for those of you attending sections locally, you'll get to see all of this in more detail with more stuff connected to it. But we're going to focus for now on these things and these things tonight, the first of which are called expansion slots. These slots here, imagine that this motherboard, when it was in its case, obviously this part of the motherboard was sticking out the back of the computer so that you could connect all of the cables like the keyboard and the mouse and so forth. So these things obviously don't stick out of the computer. But it turns out that there are these similarly blue or green plastic cards called expansion cards that you slide into these slots. Typically, there will be some connector at the end of that card that sticks out the back of the computer. These are called expansion cards because they, quote unquote, expand the capabilities of your computer. Those of you who have a modem built into your computer, which we'll discuss in 2 weeks' time, probably has a telephone port sticking out of the back. Quite likely, that telephone port is connected to an expansion card, which is connected to the motherboard by way of one of these slots. Those of you who have a network connection for like your cable modem, it's called an Ethernet connection, in the back of your computer, it too might very well be connected to an expansion card, only the back of which you are seeing, the connector on the back. Now, to be honest, many such connectors over time get subsumed into the motherboard itself. So if modems are all the rage, Ethernet cards are all the rage, manufacturers of motherboards start to build them into the motherboard itself, obviating the need for any kind of expansion card. But typically, this was the way of souping up your computer. People might go out and buy a very expensive sound card so that they could have really nice sounds coming out of their computers, a really expensive video card so that they could have really nice graphics displaying on their screen. They might buy a gigabit Ethernet card so they can have a really fast home network. And all of these network issues we'll come back to in our internet lectures. But the name pretty much describes what they do. They expand the capabilities of your computer. And so the types of expansion cards that you might have, past and present, might include, again, modems, sound cards, network cards, video cards, and several other types of cards. But really, this isn't terribly interesting of a technology because really it just allows you to retrofit your computer with some piece of functionality that it didn't come with. So think of them as really an extension of the motherboard, thereby enhancing the capabilities of your computer. But what is useful to note is the types of expansion cards that exist today. You are seeing decreasingly a type of expansion card called ISA, which is an older technology, it's a slower technology, versus PCI, which is the more popular and common today. This is relevant only because if you go out to buy an expansion card, which you might need to do if you want to retrofit an older computer with a network jack so that you can put, for instance, an old PC in your home on your home network, well, you need to know, does your motherboard have ISA slots or PCI slots? Cards go into slots. Trivial to tell them apart. One, you can just open the user's manual or ask someone else what's inside your computer. Two, just take the case off, not going to hurt anything, and just look on the motherboard. Most motherboards have several expansion slots. This isn't a desktop computer. These slots do not exist on laptops. The longer black ones are ISA. The shorter white ones are PCI. All that matters to you, the consumer, is which one do I have free, and therefore what type of card do I need to go buy. This is an older motherboard. This is a newer one. What do you notice? There's no ISA slots. And ignore this for a moment. It's not ISA, even though it is brown. There are no ISA slots. So for newer computers, this is pretty much a non-issue. And frankly, computers today tend to come with so much hardware in them, you typically don't even need to get expansion cards today. It's all built into the motherboard, or it's already inside the computer when you get it. So newer computers, PCI. But this is an issue if you're retrofitting an older computer. PSI, as you might guess, being newer, is faster. And that is the upside of it. But what is useful to note on this other motherboard is this brown slot. Another type of expansion card, which is sort of a special case, is called AGP. This is just the acronym applied to describe newer, faster video cards. stands for Advanced Graphics Port. Now, all this should be on your jargon sheet for tonight. But it's only for video cards. It's a special slot on the motherboard. Looks similar to the other slots, but it's typically, frankly, just different in color. And it's laid out slightly differently. This is the port that you would plug a new video card, aka a graphics card, into if you wanted to really soup up your computer's graphics performance. Well, what does that mean exactly? Well, every computer comes with a monitor port, the plug that you can connect your monitor to. Usually these days, that port is built into the motherboard itself. However, on this computer, I needed to have a special or just an additional video or graphics card installed because none of these ports are actually for video. So I had to buy a card to put onto this motherboard so that I could actually plug a monitor in my computer. Off-the-shelf cheap video cards are probably fine. But if you want a particularly large monitor, you're going to need probably a better video card. If you want to play the latest in computer games such that everything is flying around the screen and looking all 3D simultaneously, you need an more expensive, a faster video card. If you're just checking your mail, browsing the web, the cheapest card should do. But this is what would motivate someone to go into a store and buy a new video or graphics card. And if you do it today, odds are you're going to want to get a AGP card, but there do exist PCI video cards for older computers. But AGP is only for graphics cards. Question? You will see, you can see in section what these things look like in more detail, but you're expanding more the capabilities of the computer, because I don't have one with me, but they are plastic cards that slide into those slots and pretty much provide, in a real sense, your computer with additional ports in back. So it's unrelated to RAM, even though they are similar only insofar as they both plug into slots, but they are very different types of slots. But all of them, just to tie everything together, ultimately communicates by way of the motherboard's bus, the pathway along which data in the form of electricity can travel.
They have their own speed built into it?
Yes. These days, graphics cards, video cards, are themselves so advanced that they tend to have their own CPUs, sometimes called a GPU, graphics, a graphical processing unit. They also tend to have their own RAM, called video RAM. This, to a consumer, is only relevant if you, again, want some high-end graphic capabilities, which pretty much is for people interested in gaming or in graphics development. For typical users, it's really a non-issue. However, as we'll discuss in our multimedia lecture, if you have a particularly big monitor, again, a 21-inch monitor, and you want to run many, you want the ability to display any number of millions of colors on the screen at what's called a high refresh rate, you will also need to consider that when buying the video card. Questions?
When you said that these days most of these things they come with a motherboard, let's say I buy a computer with PCI video card, and then I realize I want a better one, I want to upgrade. So can I just get into, like, open a computer, take out a PCI, plug it in?
Good question. If you want to upgrade from PCI video cards to AGP, can you just swap one out and the other in? Only if your motherboard has an AGP slot. If it does not have an AGP slot, there will be nowhere to connect the new card, and so you will need to upgrade the whole motherboard, which is not a common situation for most people to be. Frankly, the nuisance of removing such specific parts like the motherboard from a computer these days, and the fact that it probably still works, making the computer a good hand-me-down as opposed to just throwing the hardware away, it tends to be easiest these days when you want to really upgrade your computer, give the old one to someone else or sell it, and then buy a new one. Because we'll discuss, and you'll see in sections and workshops, the computer hardware is just amazingly cheap. I get catalogs from Dell for some reason, and they advertise desktop PCs that are faster than anything I even have in my apartment now, $300, $400. I mean, it's just amazing what you get for your money these days. So, but in answer to your question, you would need a computer with an AGP slot. Yeah?
If you add low-end sound variation,
Good question. If you add such expansion cards as these to your computer, does it begin to eat up your resources like your RAM? Short answer is no. They're really not going to have an effect on your computer's performance. Good question. On the back of those motherboards are things besides, on a motherboard are things besides all of these slots and connectors. There are also those connectors or ports or jacks on the back to which you can connect external devices. Just to put a name to some of the pictures here, this is, starting easily again, this is where you plug the power cord. And it's a funny thing to even spend any time on this, but many students in this class, including many members of my family, don't, if I say just plug the power back in or plug the keyboard back in, they don't know what to do. And it's a funny thing because, one, these days almost everything is color-coded. Mice are almost always green these days. Keyboards are almost always purple. Monitors are almost always blue. But for those not so good with colors, it's the shapes also are a wonderful asset because there is only one connector on the back of the computer into which you can plug the power cord, and it looks like that trapezoid or near trapezoid. This port, or this is a depiction of a Pentium 2 or 3 motherboard, a lot of stuff going on. Those two things at the left? Not speakers. Keyboard and mouse. We can't distinguish them in this picture. They're not colored. Hopefully there is a label on the back of the computer. Otherwise, you won't know. And it is important which one you use for mouse or keyboard, because otherwise things might not work. Those are generally called PS2 ports. PS2 ports. Almost every PC has them. This is, again, a PC's motherboard, not a Mac. Macs have different ports typically. But worthy of note at this point in the evening is that I would not recommend disconnecting things like your mouse or your keyboard from a PS2 port while it is running. Typically, this will confuse the operating system, and worse yet, it is possible with this particular port to short out the wires, because if you put the plug back in while the computer's on at ever so slightly the wrong angle, you could theoretically make improper contact between different pins in the cable and short out the connector. And unfortunately, to what is this connector directly attached? The motherboard, which means if you short out the port to which your $10 keyboard connects, you need to replace the $50 or the $100 or the $200 motherboard. You can't just fix little parts like that. So with that said, the next port's over. Yeah, these are USB connectors, universal serial bus. These things are all of the rage these days. There's hardly a device you can buy these days that can't be connected to your computer via USB. Among the devices that go in here are keyboards and mice these days, more modern ones. iPods go into this slot. Printers go into this slot. Scanners go into this slot. Digital cameras. I'm saying these quickly because almost anything that has a cord these days can be connected to a USB slot. Typically, computers will have just a couple of them, maybe four, sometimes on the front, sometimes on the back, but you can also expand these with what's called a hub. Things called USB hubs exist, which are just little plastic devices that have more USB ports and one cord. You plug that cord into one of these slots, thereby making one slot into four new ones, or one into eight new ones. This is actually increasingly necessary because the more devices that come with USB connectors, the more connectors you need. Realize that it doesn't matter how many ports are built into your computer, you can expand them by connecting what's called a USB hub, which is usually $5, $10, $20, not hugely expensive. How about the connector that's in gray to the right, but the top one, the wider of the two? It's actually called a parallel port. It's wide. You recognize it just by practice. It tends to be the connector for one's printer, but before the days of USB. Most printers these days do connect via USB in the Mac and PC world. Older printers, though, tend to connect via that, the parallel port. Slower than USB. These days, you'd probably prefer getting a USB printer. The port beneath it is what? So it's the same shape and size as the monitor port. Because I know the motherboard this was taken off of, I think this actually, it could be. It's unclear. It could be either the VGA port, as it's called, or a serial port. VGA? It could be. I'm not quite sure how to it is serial, actually, because the yellow are suggesting pins. So this is what's called a serial port. Long story short, serial ports are no longer in use on computers today. Most computers. In the day, they were used for mice. They were used for modems and a few other devices, most of which now connect to computers via newer, faster technologies. But they still exist. Oh, a joystick would typically connect to the serial port. And a computer, a PC, would typically have a couple of these. The one at top right is, in fact, another type of serial port, one that's typically used for joysticks and game controllers, specifically. And beneath those, the three little holes are what? You said it first. Speakers, microphone, and line input, if you want to connect like your stereo into your computer and have sound going in, not just out. How do you distinguish them? Well, you read the labels, frankly, or the colors that are marked on them. Okay. Any questions on these various ports on the back of a computer? All right. And these coming soon. What's the one at right on the bottom? Telephone jack. What's the one at left? Okay, it's an Ethernet port. They look quite similar. One is fatter than the other, and we will revisit this in 2 weeks' time. I/O devices. This is a buzzword that it's just omnipresent in the world of computers. It's not a hard one by any means. It simply refers to input or output devices. Just to do a verbal laundry list, I think, tonight, rattle off what you would assume would be input devices. These are devices that interact with a user and connect somehow to a PC. Keyboard. Digital camera, sure. Mouse. Microphone. Scanner. So, and let's say dot, dot, dot. Any device that interacts specifically with a user, so not like a modem, but that passes input from a user to the computer. Output devices, quite obviously then, might be... The monitor, the printer, the speakers, anything that spits output to the user in some format. We toss it up there largely so that you know what the I/O abbreviation tends to mean, but it's a pretty straightforward concept these days. And incidentally, if at any point, if any of you who are particularly unsavvy with computers up to this point, and I'm taking much too much for granted, by all means, pull me aside. Speak with me after so that we can too bring you up to speed. I don't mean to be assuming too much, but I'm trying to cater to as many folks as possible. Finally, a word on monitors and the kinds of things you should bear in mind. This too is sort of a slide being deprecated by time. These days, a lot of people are getting LCD screens, LCD, liquid crystal display, the flat screen monitors. In fact, Dell will toss those in typically for free when you buy a $300 or $400 computer. Back in the day, last year and before, more common were CRTs, you know, the big monitors, cathode ray tubes. They're identical to TVs in principle. Those were much bigger. Some of these terms, older TV sets, not to the flat screen TV sets. But these were the kinds of metrics that were useful to be aware of in the world of CRTs. Because this is rather increasingly inapplicable, I will mention only what's relevant to today's usage for now. Color depth refers to the amount of colors, the number of colors that your computer can display. You see this, for instance, in the world of Windows, if you bring up something like your control panel, choosing what's called your display control panel, though Macs have an equivalent concept. Under settings, you'll see something like this, color quality. This is actually somewhat dumbed down. High means it shows lots of colors. Specifically, 32 bits uses 32 bits to represent each pixel or each dot on the screen. That means, using last week's math, that every pixel on a computer's monitor, if set to highest quality, can display any number of 4 billion different colors, most of which the human eye cannot even distinguish. So this is sort of a moot point for monitors. But if I put the computer into medium quality, 16-bit color, that allows you only 65,536 colors. A human can actually begin to distinguish that if you're looking at your monitor, on your monitor, at things like photographs. where you might actually want to have many more gradients than 65,000 would allow. You probably can't tease all 65,000 colors apart, but you would notice because it would be more splotchy. It wouldn't be as smooth, a transition from one part of the photo to another. So that's what we mean by color depth, or number of colors displayed. Resolution is relevant too, even to computers today with LCDs or CRTs, the number of pixels that your computer can display. A pixel is the dot that makes up one portion of your screen. If you've never noticed these things before, when no one else is watching, go up tonight and look really closely at your computer monitor and count them. You will see roughly 800 pixels across and 600 pixels down, or maybe 1024 pixels across, 768 pixels down. In short, and I'll give you a few of the common numbers that you see for monitors' resolution. Previously, all the rage was 640 by 480. More common today is 800 by 600, or maybe 1024 by 768. There's others in between. The largest that I can make out, frankly, is what I use on my monitor, which is 1600 by 1200. What this refers to, essentially, is how many dots are being crammed into your computer screen. If you decrease your monitor's resolution, which I could do here, but I'd rather not on the display computer because doing things with projectors attached tends to mess things up. If I change from 1024 pixels across to 800, decreasing them therefore, you essentially have larger dots on the screen, which has the effect of making everything look bigger. So frankly, this is particularly relevant for adults who would prefer to see things larger on the screen, particularly as people age, when it just becomes really difficult or a nuisance to look at terribly small text. Well, by decreasing your monitor's resolution, not changing the physical size of your monitor, the end result is to make things look bigger. But of course, less stuff fits on the screen at once because you have less space, but it's sort of all zoomed in. LCDs, however, you can sometimes adjust the resolution. But most LCDs have a sweet spot, if you will, where if you change the resolution of an LCD, the flat panel displays, things get very ugly quickly. It might look bigger, but it's not going to look nearly as pretty, as refined as the default setting was. But on CRTs, the old type of monitors, it's quite a useful thing. Yeah? Good question. Why even downgrade the number of colors being displayed? The short answer is that, particularly for older computers where video RAM was tight, video RAM being the RAM that comes with your video card or graphics card, it was always a trade-off. If you wanted to increase your resolution, you could, but you might have to decrease your color depth because the card only has enough capabilities to do one thing or the other, not both. So it was often a trade-off. With newer computers, particularly those with good hardware, you can kind of do whatever you want with them. And briefly, only because it's of decreasing relevance, dot pitches on a CRT refers to how close together those dots can be. The smaller the dot pitch, the sharper the image will look. So in short, if you were buying a CRT today still, which most of you will not, you'd want the smallest dot pitch, which is measured in millimeters. Refresh rate, for those of you perhaps at work with CRTs that tend to get headaches staring at your computer all day, may very well be the result of your monitor being at a very low refresh rate. This refers to, in hertz, the number of times per second that the screen is redrawn. Long story short, just as with a TV, you have a little a gun of sorts in the back of a monitor or an old TV that shoots electrons at the glass, or really at something behind the glass. And it does this many times per second, top to bottom. If your refresh rate is relatively low, 60 times per second, your monitor only gets repainted, if you will, 60 times per second. That's about the bare minimum. However, on larger monitors, and you can see this if you pull up a perfectly white screen, you'll see a flicker. And it's sort of tough to put your finger on, but you'll feel like things are flickering. And this actually tends to induce in some people, myself included, headaches. If you increase one's refresh rate, again only on a CRT, to like 85 hertz, 85 repaintings per second, the screen becomes much more constant and therefore less headache inducing. You can see in movies, the effects of refresh rates going on. When if you've ever seen a movie or TV show where they filmed someone's computer monitor, you see that waving line from top to bottom. That is simply because the video camera is only shooting at, say, 30 frames per second. The monitor is being refreshed at, say, 60 times per second, but they're not quite synchronized. So what you see is the screen being repainted over time, and you catch it at different passes from through the screen from top to bottom. LCDs do not have refresh rates. They simply stay statically the same constantly. There's no such redrawing. Okay. Printers, I never spend much time on, and I will defer this to offline conversation if you'd like, come in two flavors, laser and inkjet printers. For now, let's just say that, how about, laser is better, laser is more expensive, but I think frankly most, if not all of you, have probably seen the difference before, and the quality sort of speaks for itself, and it really boils down to how much you want to pay and what quality you're willing to accept. Worthy of note now, though, is that these days color laser printers remain rather or relatively expensive. So for printing photos, most people do get inkjet printers. But inkjet printers for photos have gotten particularly good, especially if you use very good, like, Kodak paper, so that you can print out really nice-looking photos using an inkjet printer. But if you were to print out something like a Photoshop document on that same inkjet printer on normal paper, it would look kind of fuzzy, you know, something that a student might hand in as a paper, but not as a really sharp professional output. But I'm happy to discuss these offline if you'd like. Because we conclude with a couple of comments on how to buy a computer. And you will do this, in fact, in, I think, problem set 3. So it's not this will not be the last night you consider how to buy a computer. What we've done this night and last time was hopefully give you a lot of the building blocks. And even if they haven't all quite fallen into place, that's fine, because particularly in problem set 3, you'll be given a shopping list of sorts, a list of sorts, for the kinds of questions you'll need to ask when, for that problem set, you're tasked with spending $1,000 or $2,000 of our virtual E1 dollars. But the kinds of questions you'll have to consider, especially when working within a budget, which I'm realizing needs to be decreased ever so more every year, since $2,000, real or not, you can go kind of nuts in a computer store these days, you'll need to ask yourself, well, first of all, how fast of a CPU do I want in this box, and what's that going to cost me? That's something you have control over. How big of a hard drive do I want, and what's that going to cost me? How much RAM should I put into the computer? Reasonable questions to ask would be, is it smart of me to get let's say, 2 gigabyte hard drive years ago and 2 gigabytes of RAM? Well, probably not for reasons of cost, and it just doesn't make that much sense because you can't even store much more than that on your hard drive. Just sort of obvious, but logical questions that one might ask. L1, L2 cache, these are the kinds of things you're going to consider? Yeah, not so much. The more is better, but if you go in and ask someone at CompUSA, how much L1 cache is on this motherboard, if it's not on that label, he's probably not going to know either. But you can know, certainly by checking such resources online or just reading more of the fine print on the advertisements. But you have to realize that if an ad does say, wow, our motherboard has 512 kilobytes of L2 cache, it's not really a selling point because most motherboards or CPUs probably have as much as well. So hopefully with that problem set, you'll be able to distinguish, you know, what's actually useful information and what's just marketing wrapped around the purchase of this computer. But what I'd like to leave us tonight is with an incredibly rapid look at history, which is meant to be exactly that, since it's next week when we'll look in more detail by way of our film at history. But this is the Mark I. This was a personal computer, if you will, back in 1943. I'll leave it to you to skim the description at the bottom, because this is really just meant to be a quick overview of where we've come from. This is a matter we'll revisit in our programming lecture. This was the first bug in a computer program. Quite literally, or at least according to stories, this was a moth of sorts found inside of the Mark I computer, which was causing it to err during its computations. And it was taped to these notes by Grace Murray Hopper, one of the first computer operators. And as legend has it, herein rose the term bug to describe a mistake in a computer or a computer program, as we'll revisit in our programming lecture. Well, 1975 saw the introduction of what was called the Altair 8800, and this was the box that Bill Gates and Steve Ballmer went nuts over and essentially wrote one of the first operating systems for. And you'll see more of these details in the film. This, of course, is Bill Gates, and at left, Paul Allen, who was one of the original and now quite wealthy Americans who came out of Microsoft, sitting with some of their earliest of computers for which they ran DOS, an operating system. This is Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak, who you will see depicted in next week's films, the founders of Apple, holding up in an Italian publication, if you see, one of the Mac's first motherboards. You see then in 1977, that same year, the advent of the Apple II computer, which was actually at the time leaps and bounds beyond the capabilities of the previous incarnations of a personal computer and actually predated what we came to know as the IBM PC compatible, or the IBM compatible PC. But it was thrown into the spotlight, if only for one piece of software that was like a precursor to Microsoft Excel, a wonderfully simple yet useful spreadsheet program, such that the Apple II computer was incredibly useful in just business environments, because no longer were accounting ledgers kept by hand. You could now input them into a computer. One of the first most compelling applications for the thing, and this is actually an excerpt thereof. Well, we get almost to the end of our history lesson. In 1981 was introduced the IBM PC, with its own green monochrome screen and huge hunking device. You'll see more about this in this coming week's film. And then you see finally in 1984, Apple's next step forward, followed by several years of decline, with the Macintosh, which was a truly graphical computer based on some designs from Xerox. And it was with this final concluding video that Apple Computer introduced this technology to the world. Commercial aired once during the Super Bowl in 1984 and never aired on TV again. The blue overtones of the commercial hinting at what was at the time Big Blue, or IBM. And it is on this battle between Apple and Microsoft that we will focus in next week's Lecture 3. See you then.